This is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, why have good sex scenes disappeared from the big screen? Movie critic Anne Hornaday mourns the loss. Then musician Eleni Mandel taught inmates how to write songs, and those classes inspired her latest album.
What I thought about a lot were actions and regrets, and how can we repair the mistakes we've made? And what if we can't? How do we live with ourselves if we can't repair the mistakes we've made?
And Anita Sarkeesian was targeted by online haters for saying that video games were sexist, but she's not backing down. All that coming up on The Frame from KPCC's Moen Broadcast Center. Stick around.
KPCC podcasts are supported by HBO, presenting Game of Thrones. Critics have hailed the final season as TV's greatest show of all time, and era-defining, Emmy-eligible for Outstanding Drama Series and all other categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. There's something really satisfying about having a good laugh or a good cry at the movies. Washington Post movie critic Anne Hornaday says there's a somewhat similar personal reaction you can get from watching a well-crafted sex scene. The only problem is there are a lot fewer of those scenes in movies these days. Sure, you can find scenes of gratuitous nudity or sexual violence used for shock value, but what about a thoughtful lovemaking scene that just feels romantic and sexy? Here's Washington Post movie critic Anne Hornaday.
I came of age in the 70s and 80s when I just feel that there was this certain kind of sex scene in movies that maybe they didn't push the envelope, you know, in terms of formalism or even necessarily content. But the way that they were staged and choreographed and executed were really genuinely fun to watch and kind of, you know, once in a while that they would quote unquote turn you on. And it was just part of the pleasure of seeing the movie. It wasn't necessarily thought to be, you know, particularly subversive or transgressive. It was just a part of the movie, of movie grammar. And I just feel like that element of kind of mainstream sex scene, you know, has just been lost. It's either now the purview of these edgy art house auteurs who are trying to push it as far as it could go, or it's just very, very quickly glossed over.
The thing that I remember from the 80s and 90s is that some of those scenes that I think we're talking about, movies like Body Heat or An Officer and a Gentleman, they were provocative, but they weren't explicit.
Exactly. You're exactly right. They weren't, because as a matter of fact, it's interesting. I had occasion to rewatch Officer and a Gentleman recently.
There's still no excuse. You're not going out getting what you want. Just go get it.
And who says I'm not going after what I want?
Not me.
And I had forgotten what a good scene that was. For all of those reasons, you know, and it wasn't that it went all that far, quote unquote. It was really about the chemistry between the actors, which apparently there really wasn't any chemistry between Deborah Winger and Richard Gere. They really weren't getting along that well, and maybe that's why it worked so well, but it was just such a sweet scene. It was just beautifully conceived and beautifully executed, and you just don't see that much anymore.
It feels like one of the things that might be driving this is that the big studios are focused on what they call a four-quadrant film, a film that will play
exactly
to men and women, old and young. Those are the four quadrants.
Right.
And they don't want to offend anybody. And so they take this kind of prudish take on sex. At the same time, they take what I would consider as a parent to be a very aggressive stance on violence. So it does feel like maybe we have our values wrong about sex being something that people can't enjoy, even if they're going, you know, God forbid, with their kids to go see a movie.
I think that's a very good point. And other, like, emailers have one email I got did point up the whole the ratings board and the hypocrisy with the rating system and going after sex where they really let all manner of violence get a PG-13 rating, and then they get really, you know, they get really freaked out around sexual expression. I do think that's a hypocrisy. And now I do think that in a post-Me Too world, that there's an extra level of not wanting to offend or putting a foot wrong. But like to your point about the four quadrant, that's why we have these superhero movies, which are the most sexless movies on the, you know, in the world. You know, you might have some elusive moments, you know, between Elizabeth Olsen and Paul Bettany in an Avengers movie, but it just seems like the whole business model is almost militating against it.
I think one of the other things that you can argue about is you can take a very popular cable television show, and I'm thinking of Game of Thrones, which has a lot of sex and nudity. Now, I would say that a lot of that sex doesn't really advance the story. It feels really gratuitous, but it does prove that there can be an audience for a show that has a fair amount of sexual content. So I wonder if maybe the studios are kind of missing the boat, because I think the audience wouldn't run away from it.
I think you're right. And I guess, you know, I think the subtext to this is it's really part and parcel, you know, with the death of the adult drama. I mean, I think that's kind of what we're talking about here, because when you're exactly right that it can feel gratuitous. Definitely cable and streaming have glommed onto this as a way, the reason, you know, for people to watch them and not go to movies. So, you know, obviously if people are gravitating toward that, they want it and they're interested in it. But then, like, where would you put it? I mean, I think we have rom-coms. We have delightful rom-coms, but they're not really going there in terms of these scenes. And when you think of the Officer and Gentleman and Body Heat type movies, they're not even making those sorts of movies much anymore.
Do you think studios are essentially prudish?
Well, I think their business model is their business model. And as long as they're married to this four quadrant, and now, you know, it's very oriented toward the international market. And so I think that's also going to be a factor in their decision making about what can they export and being sensitive to cultural sensibilities. But on the other hand, this awards movie, you know, these Oscar movies, as long as studios still want to be in that game and have that prestige, those are the kinds of movies that this belongs in, you know, the ones that are done with some degree of sophistication and taste and humanism. There's that little sliver of hope that this can still find a way, you know, within studio movies.
And as you point out in your piece, a sexy scene doesn't necessarily have to involve sex. You cite a scene that I think a lot of people who've seen the movie will agree is one of the steamier scenes where everybody is dressed, and that is Kevin Costner painting Susan Sarandon's toenails in Bull Durham.
Oh my goodness. That is, you know, it's just a classic. And then of course that great scene in Notorious where Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman just kissed for, it seems like 24 hours. It's just fabulous.
Anne Hordaday is the chief film critic at the Washington Post, and she wants more sex in movies. I hope you get your wish.
Oh my goodness, I can't believe that.
Coming up next on The Frame, singer-songwriter Eleni Mandel and the album inspired by her work with female inmates.
60 Minute Men. KPCC podcasts are supported by HBO, presenting Sharp Objects, based on the best-selling novel by Gillian Flynn. The story focuses on Camille Preaker, a journalist with a history of psychiatric issues who returns to her rural hometown to cover the apparent murders of two preteen girls. The limited series was hailed by critics as exquisite, hauntingly compelling, and a true masterpiece. Emmy eligible for Outstanding Limited Series and all other categories. Visit hbo.com/FYC for more on Sharp Objects.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Now LA-based songwriter and educator Eleni Mandel. Her most recent album, Wake Up Again, was inspired by her work with female prisoners in Southern California. She taught songwriting through Jail Guitar Doors. It's a music education program founded by MC5 guitarist Wayne Kramer. As you can imagine, her students were grappling with a lot of things, including intense emotions. And in the process of teaching the inmates to write songs, Mandel found herself reflecting on her own feelings about loneliness and regret. We'll start with a song off the album called Air, which she wrote during one of her prison lessons.
There's no fun in this town, no music or dancing, no shade trees around, no late night romancing.
I would come up with writing assignments kind of on my way to work. It's a long drive because the prison's pretty far out there. And so I thought, okay, we'll write about, you know, air, water, fire, earth. And air was the first one. And what I would do is I would say, okay, this, you know, this is the topic. Everybody write down one line and we'll share. And so I felt it was important to participate in that myself, and how I can take something, an idea, and turn it into a sentence or a line, and then it grows from there. So I wrote, "There is no air on the moon," just the first thing that popped in my head. And so that song isn't about the prison. It's about, you know, it was just written at the prison. However, the second part where I say, "There's no fun in this town, no music or dancing," one of the inmates, after I did that line, said, "Wow, that sounds just like here." So I don't know. I think the influence it had on me is not even really known to me. It's just sort of all swirling around me and it happens.
How would you categorize what you're taking away from these classes that change you, change the way you see inmates, the world? I mean, it's a long list.
Gosh.
But what did you learn?
Wow. Well, what I thought about a lot were actions and regrets. How do we be our best selves? And how can we repair the mistakes we've made? And what if we can't? How do we live with ourselves if we can't repair the mistakes we've made? And I also thought a lot about how anybody can make mistakes. You know, some of these inmates, I had a lawyer, a nurse, a teacher, an elementary school teacher, people who were smart, who had lives and husbands and children, and mistakes were made. And then, of course, economically disadvantaged people as well.
The lyric that I have circled even before you came in here from Wake Up Again is, "Was it my fate to make those mistakes? If I had the chance, would I, could I wake up again?" And you can think of those words being spoken by somebody who was in prison for 30 years. And you can think about somebody who is out working in the real world who didn't do the right thing when somebody was in crisis.
Yeah. And I think even though the songs were informed by the work I did there, I guess in some ways they're as much about me and my experiences and my fears as they are about them. And I did have one student who I found out was in prison for the death of her grandchild. And I have been angry at my children, and I have said things and been angry in a way I didn't know I was capable of. And I think about her, and just that's split second where it's too late. As a parent, it's pretty terrifying.
We're talking with Eleni Mandel about her new album called Wake Up Again. I want to play another song off the album. This one is called Circumstance.
I live in gray and blue. That's the colors they choose. Says to stop, you have to drop to the ground until they say you can get back up. This is my circumstance.
I understand this song was informed by two women in particular. What were the circumstances of Circumstance?
Yeah, that was the first one I wrote, and both of them had said to me, well, it wasn't my fault. It just happened. And I had spoken with a woman a lot who worked in that area and had worked there for a really long time in restorative justice, and how it's so hard for them to opt to take this restorative justice class, which is a two-year class, which always reduces their time, because to be able to take responsibility is so hard. And make those reparations.
Because it also means admitting guilt.
Right. This idea, like, your circumstance and the root of those words, and how you see a lot of women when you're walking through the yard to the classroom, you see them standing around. And, just, wow.
Standing around.
You are spending time with people who are in lockup for various reasons. How do you make sure that what they are sharing, you're not appropriating?
Yeah. I definitely tried really hard to respect that. I didn't want should they ever hear these songs, for any of them to feel any kind of violation of privacy. I shared with them as much, I think, as they shared with me, which I had been trained not to do. But I felt like as a songwriter...
Trained not to share your emotions. Yeah. Keep them private. Don't let them know anything about you.
Yes.
A lot of people get the same training.
But I felt like, how can I teach someone how to write a song if I don't show them and if we don't share and develop trust? The only song where I take something that maybe is very personal. So for instance, like the song, What's Your Handle? Is also about two women who shared the same story that they were taking my class not to write music, but to feel close to their own children who loved music. And I thought that was incredibly profound. So they shared that with me, but I don't say in the song. It's mixed in there. You have to interpret that.
When you see people who are locked up, how would you describe what music means to them and how it might be different from the way music means something to all the other people that you've met in your life before?
I think in some ways their experience of music is like my experience of music growing up, because they don't get to, you know, be on the internet and live stream. And so they're still holding on to songs in this meaningful way that we did in the 70s and 80s and 90s before everything changed. So it feels more important to them. And I love that, and I miss that feeling for myself, too.
I want to play another song that came about, I think, during one of your classes. It's called Oh Mother. I want to talk not about the lyrics, but about the music. Can you talk about the sound of this record and how would you describe your collaborative process?
Ryan Fevis, the bass player, and Kevin Fitzgerald, the drummer, and I have played music together for 15 or 20 years. And so to me, they are the second family, my musical family. And the guitar player, Milo Jones, is my new husband, which is pretty cool. And gosh, you know, when I feel like I really know a musician and they really know me and we go in together, it's sort of just magic. It just happens. I mean, it's all who you surround yourself with, I guess.
When you think about that idea of the collaborative spirit that you work with your collaborators on this record, is there a way to teach that to people who are in prison about how you work together, how you partner? Is that something that you can even
address? We did some stuff like that. I started a class on another day. They said, you know, we need you to fill in more time or something. So I started one called Band Practice, where every song was written as a group. I would say, what mood should this be? And someone would have an idea. And then we had a couple of extra instruments. And so they sort of experienced that magic. And my real hope was just that they'd find another community that was more productive for them.
Eleni, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
If I could rewind, go back in time, leave you.
Coming up, media critic and feminist Anita Sarkeesian's campaign against sexist depictions in video games.
Make the noise stop spinning around.
Media critic and feminist Anita Sarkeesian made headlines a couple of years ago when she called out sexist and misogynistic depictions in video games. Sarkeesian's criticism triggered threats of graphic violence against her and virtual nonstop online harassment, part of what became known as Gamergate. Her latest project aims to root out toxic depictions of LGBTQ characters in gaming. The Frame contributor Stephen Cuevas recently spoke with Sarkisian, and he has our story.
In the first episode of the three-part Queer Tropes in Gaming series, directed by Anita Sarkisian, host Carolyn Pettit explains its core objective.
We need more games in which queer characters and queer identities simply exist, whether the player chooses to access that content or not.
Sounds simple, but Sarkisian points out that such transformations never came so easy in Hollywood, a big influence on game producers.
Games, I think, still struggle with how to tell narrative, and so they pull out these tropes, which are not necessarily bad things, right? Too often, though, they are used to reinforce harmful stereotypes.
Well, let's hear a clip from early on in the first episode. Carolyn Pettit is talking about a 90s-era arcade game called Crime Fighters 2.
Players face queer-coded enemies in leather with exaggeratedly effeminate walking animations who literally dry-hump the player as an attack. But they don't stop there. These guys will dry-hump anything. If there's a lamppost handy, hell, they'll hump that too.
Yeah, it's just bananas.
It makes me laugh every time.
Yeah, I mean, like, when you first saw video games like that, what was your response? It was my first time, and I was like, are you kidding me?
We are providing a reframing for a lot of people who grew up on these games. So, like, games that you had played when you were younger that you didn't ever notice that queer folks are demonized in these various ways, that now all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, I played hours of this game and had no idea until I got older or were given the tools to be able to deconstruct them.
It's a digital realm that's also starting to draw scrutiny from national organizations that track hate and extremism, including the Anti-Defamation League.
There's issues with toxic behavior, hate and harassment in online games. Part of this issues with the culture of the game companies themselves.
Daniel Kelly is co-director of the ADL Center for Technology and Society, launched in 2016 to combat hate and extremism across the gaming universe, from the video games themselves to live streaming player platforms like Twitch. The ADL is now working with game designing companies to come up with video games that can foster inclusion and tolerance.
At the same time that there's toxic and hateful culture and practice in games, there's also, I think, incredible potential for games and the process of creating games to be a tool to help folks explore these issues and to change and sharpen their minds.
Anita Sarkisian says she has seen gradual improvements in recent years, partly because game designers are starting to see that being more inclusive is actually good for the bottom line.
Having a female protagonist is not going to make your game fail. If you make a good game, people are going to want to play it. We're seeing more opportunities for different kinds of narratives, protagonists, different kinds of villains than we have historically been seeing in games.
Feminist Frequency's Queer Tropes in Gaming series does spotlight some of those games. One that host Carolyn Pettit points to is the award-winning first-person exploration game Gone Home. The story includes a blossoming romance between two young women, Samantha and Lonnie.
And the game ultimately creates a feeling of warmth and safety that validates queer love.
Lonnie came over today. Lonnie, do you think you could ever... And that's when she kissed me.
Since its upload in March, the Queer Tropes in Gaming series has racked up tens of thousands of views on YouTube. The series is designed in part to help video games evolve and to spark healthy conversation. But Sarkisian disabled the comment section.
YouTube is trash, and people are very mean to us and post horrific things. So why would we allow that discourse to flourish in our spaces? We get to make the choice whether we want to allow that on our YouTube channel, which we do not.
Sarkisian knows something about horrific comments. Her 2012 series, Tropes vs. Women in Video Games, called out sexist and misogynistic portrayals and narratives in gaming. And it triggered a nasty backlash that included rape and death threats, and even the creation of a crude video game where players could assault Sarkisian. She spoke out about the attacks on Comedy Central's Colbert Report in 2014.
They're actually responding to the fact that we're saying gaming can no longer be this little boys club anymore, that there are many of us women who have been playing our games our whole lives. We're challenging the status quo of gaming as a male-dominated space.
Well, okay, can't they have their own Do you see, do you hear the applause for the idea of a male-dominated space?
The harassment was horrible, and it's not over.
The threats of violence have led to the occasional cancellation of speaking engagements and taking extra security precautions when out in public, including when visiting KPCC. But it turns out Sarkeesian's series also accidentally exposed the toxic nexus between the openly racist, anti-feminist, extremist ideology of the so-called alt-right and a faction within the gaming community.
It sounds nefarious because it actually is.
Sarkeesian believes the same type of online harassment and rhetoric used to attack her and others as far back as 2012 have since seeped into our daily politics.
You can see the copycat of the tactics that were used to harass us that then the Trump administration and supporters of him used in order to recruit, in order to spread conspiracy theories. And it is very concerning for the future of like online discourse and literally our political landscape, and we're seeing the costs of this.
Sarkeesian says she's now working on a project that'll delve deeper into the connections between extremist ideology and the world of gaming. For The Frame, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
And speaking of Stephen Cuevas, he'll be filling in for me while I'm off on vacation for the next week and a half. That is it for today. From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We are back here tomorrow.